It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
It's the Media Buzz Meter with Howard Kurtz.
This is the dumbest television mistake in more than half a century. CBS pulling a Heidi. I'll explain the reference to you youngins in just a moment. So CBS heavily promoted the 100th Billy Joel at Madison Square Garden, the greatest arena run of all time. And it aired a few days ago. And wait, this gets worse. He's singing his classic song, Piano Man. He's up to the final verse, so maybe at most there's 90 seconds to go. And all CBS stations cut away to local news broadcasts. Okay, here's the even dumber part. So the special ran about 30 minutes late because the Masters golf tournament went long. So it's already 11:30 at night. It's supposed to start at 11. Okay, they want to get to the local newscasts. So what would be the great tragedy if they delayed it by 2 more minutes? Well, and the Heidi reference is what NBC did more than 50 years ago when there were basically 3 broadcast networks. And there was a major New York Jets game on, final few minutes, not clear who was going to win. And they cut away to a show called Heidi, because that was supposed to start at 7 Eastern. And football fans went nuts. Okay, so now CBS announces that they will run this again, the Billy Joel special again, this Friday. Here's the quote. A network programming timing error. All right, well, I got to stop right there. That's BS. Somebody screwed this up. Somebody made this decision. Ended the Billy Joel special approximately 2 minutes early in the Eastern and Central time zones. We apologize to Mr. Joel, his fans, our affiliated stations, and our audience whose viewing experience was interrupted during the last song. What a bunch of dumbasses. All right, let's get right down to business. Story number one. The first day of the first criminal trial ever held involving a former president. Now, a lot of people are leading with jury selection, which, by the way, looks like it's going to go on for at least a couple of weeks. So they didn't get to jury selection. There actually was much more important stuff that happened earlier. They didn't get to jury selection until about 2 o'clock. So they had about 2.5 hours. First group was brought in, 96 prospective jurors. They were asked, can you be impartial about Donald Trump? Remember, this is a Manhattan grand jury in a borough where most people don't like Donald Trump. 50 people immediately said, no, I can't possibly be impartial. So they're dismissed. And they ended up with a few possibilities, but nobody actually chosen. I think that indicates how hard it's going to be to get a jury. Now, look, some of those people may have just wanted to get out of it or not be stuck in a trial that's estimated to last 6 weeks, maybe longer. Also, Judge Juan Merchan made a series of rulings, and this is the important part. Most unfavorable to the Trump defense, some favorable. But these requests, well, this is basically the prosecution, the Manhattan DA's office saying, here is what we would like to introduce once the jury is seated. And is basically to remind people about what a tabloid life Donald Trump has led, about past sexual controversies involving Donald Trump. And much of that will be allowed within limits. So, I don't know. I kind of think that, yeah, you got to set the stage and the Bragg argument. And by the way, there was a big New York Times piece about, oh, Alvin Bragg is, he's so non-political. You can't believe how non-political he is. Yeah, right. Okay, anyway. They want to set the stage that this shows his intent in terms of Stormy Daniels, the fact that he had these previous affairs and controversies. So, first of all, the judge refused to step aside. Second, he did reject a request by prosecutors to introduce accusations of sexual assault that various women lodged against Trump years ago, calling them rumors and complete gossip. So that's one for the Trump side. By the way, there was also a spat over the gag order because Trump went pretty hard after Michael Cohen, who will be the star witness, who has serious credibility problems of his own as a convicted perjurer. And Cohen's the guy who paid the $130,000 to the porn star toward the final weeks of the 2016 campaign to shut her up. Now, another ruling. Remember, Trump says he's going to take the witness stand, but I don't. His lawyers don't want him to do that, so we'll see. There will be another witness named Karen McDougal. That name vaguely rings a bell. She is a former Playboy, Playmate of the Year, I think, but certainly a Playboy model, who, unlike Stormy Daniels, only claims she had one night, spent one night with Donald Trump, which he denies. She says they had kind of a love affair that lasted 10 months. And she was also, she was paid off by the National Enquirer in this sense. And this has all come out. $150,000 to, in exchange for basically keeping her mouth shut about Trump, she'd be given a column in one of then owner David Pecker's magazines like Health and Fitness or something like that. Hope Hicks could be a key witness here. There are a lot of them. But as far as the other things showing how prosecutors want to paint a picture of Donald Trump and his life, there was the infamous Access Hollywood tape. Grab him by the P. You know, when you're a star, they allow you to do it. Grab them by the genitals. You can do anything, Trump said. So Judge Merchan ruled that they can't play the tape. He doesn't think it's fair to hear Trump's voice and what he's saying, but they can talk about the tape as well as any emails that followed it. And they can question witnesses about the tape. Judge saying you can bring out what was said in the tape. He just didn't want jurors to hear it. Now, Trump's lawyer, Todd Blanche, asked the judge to reconsider on the Access Hollywood business, calling this extremely salacious evidence, very prejudicial. Well, that's the point. That's why prosecutors want to use it. And as far as the bottom line here, look, is there anyone in America who doesn't already know that Donald Trump had been a well-documented playboy? I don't think so. I don't think that changes any minds. This is already a stretch, an openly partisan case by an elected Democrat. Just to remind you, his predecessor as DA, Cy Vance Jr., declined to bring the case. The feds declined to bring the case. And at worst, because there was falsification of records to reimburse Cohn, it's a misdemeanor case, but Bragg is somehow stretched into a felony. But, and it's starting again today, early in the morning, cable news networks, in fact, news outlets from around the world are set up outside this somewhat dingy Lower Manhattan courthouse. And at one time I heard an anchor say, well, we have breaking news. Here are new pictures from within the courthouse. You did get to see Trump walk in. He gave a little speech before he walked in. MSNBC did not break away from this for more than, I don't know, maybe 10 minutes on Israel now and then. CNN covered it very heavily, but broke away more. Fox was certainly covered it. You had the Fox cameras there and everything else. But also covered other news, particularly in the Middle East, which we'll get to in the podcast too. And here's what Trump said before he went in. This is an assault on America. Nothing like this has ever happened before. Every legal scholar says this case is nonsense. Well, not exactly. It never should have been brought. Never been anything like it. It's an outrage. People don't necessarily like Donald Trump, says Donald Trump, say this is an outrage that this case was brought. This is political persecution. Country run by an incompetent man, very much involved in this case. Except Joe Biden has gone out of his way not to even comment on it. And here's the thing. Trump then also said afterwards, my son, that's Barron, is graduating from high school. It looks like the judge will not let me go to the graduation of my son, who's worked very, very hard, and he is a great student. But actually, I'm sure this was reported in a couple places, but I didn't see it. It certainly wasn't played up until this item in the Huffington Post. What Judge Merchan actually said is that may be possible for Trump to attend the May 17th high school graduation, but he'd have to see how the trial develops, according to the AP. It really depends on how we're doing on time and where we are in the trial, Merchan said. If the trial proceeds as planned, he's willing to adjourn for the day. He did, however, tell Trump he could face arrest if he disrupts the proceedings or misses court. Now, there's a certain irony here because Donald Trump has continued to attack Judge Merchan's daughter, who is a Democratic activist, but she's an adult and works for a lot of Democratic candidates. Trump is now saying, well, can you grant me this favor or disposition for one of my children? But the point is, he may get it, he may not get it, but Merchan didn't say no.
Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network, subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.
Moving right along here. Washington Post says Americans have overwhelmingly found the facts of this case to be problematic. It's easy to cast the New York charges against Trump. His alleged falsification of business records to conceal a hush money payment as small bore, not to mention partisan. Relative to Trump's allegedly subverting American democracy after the 2020 election and jeopardizing national security by withholding classified documents, it is. But it's also similar It's also a situation, where Americans were quite concerned when it kind of broke through in 2018. Polling then showed 8 in 10 Americans regarded Trump's actions as either legal or unethical. Yeah, but that was a long time ago. And yet, he easily won the nomination. And depending on which polls you look at, he has a good shot, or at least a reasonable shot, of becoming president again. Well, here's Clay Travis, who's a regular guest on my show, sports commentator, the co-founder of Outlook. Excuse me, Outkick. Okay, don't sue me, honest mistake. And now a nationally syndicated radio host. He wrote on X, "If you're a Trump supporter in New York City who is part of the jury pool, do everything you can to get seated on the jury and then refuse to convict as a matter of principle, dooming the case via a hung jury. It's the most patriotic thing you could possibly do." Well, Fox columnist David Marcus replied, "This is a dangerous road that requires the violation of a sworn oath, but I get it." Another quote from a lawyer named Bradley Moss: "Clay is arguably conspiring to commit jury tampering here by encouraging someone to deliberately engage in jury nullification. Not a wise move by Clay." Look, jury selection is the whole thing. So Trump's best hope, being tried in Manhattan, is to get one jury who's a juror who's a holdout. But what bothers me about Clay's suggestion is it's like the OJ case, which we covered on the Media Buzz on Sunday. Many of the black jurors and minority jurors who voted to acquit OJ Simpson despite a mountain of evidence that he had committed a double murder knew he was probably guilty. And yet, they wanted to be on his side. So they decided to ignore the evidence and declare him innocent. Moving further along, just one other item in the Trump world here. RFK Jr. said that members of Trump's inner circle asked him to run as Trump's vice president. "President Trump calls me an ultra-left radical. I'm so liberal that his emissaries asked me to be his VP. I respectfully declined the offer. I'm against President Trump, and President Biden can't win." Well, I know a little bit about this, not the specifics of RFK, but the predominant thinking in the Trump camp is that he's not going to announce any running mate until close to the convention, just for the sheer suspense of it. And I think what they were doing was sounding him out. I don't know why. Couldn't see that happening if he's an ultra-left radical, except anyway, there we go. Story two. Mike Johnson risks angering many of his members with a convoluted plan to placate his critics on the right, while also giving national security hawks a chance to advance billions of dollars in aid to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. He will put 4 different bills on the floor this week, he hopes. Decoupling aid for Israel, which, of course, we all dramatically saw, faced a barrage of 300 drones and missiles from Iran, directly from Iran, over the weekend. From help from Ukraine, which is much more controversial inside the GOP conference. Then he'll advance separate votes for aid to Taiwan and a measure to satisfy Republican foreign policy demands, including the seizure of Russian assets and a House-approved bill that could ban TikTok in the U.S. Nowhere are the border security measures. Well, they already tried that route, and Trump came out against it. And that's why nothing has passed the House. Johnson: "Every member ultimately will be able to vote his own conscience on all these matters, and everybody have the opportunity to weigh in." Major gamble by Johnson, who obviously is the subject of a motion to vacate, if by Marjorie Taylor Greene. She hasn't actually done it. Greene said the Johnson plan is a scam and she's firmly against it, but hasn't yet said whether she will follow up on trying to knock him out of that job. I support the majority and I want it next time, so I'm being careful. He's definitely not going to be speaker next Congress if we're lucky enough to have the majority. Johnson, I don't spend my time worrying about motions to vacate. We're having to govern here. We're going to do our job. However, given what's basically a two-vote margin in the House right now, a group of far-right members may not go along with this and could prevent it from going to the floor. I hadn't realized that. So, look, I mentioned last week that Johnson couldn't get the FISA bill, the reauthorizing of spying bill through, but in a couple more attempts, he did get it through. So he's not, he knows how to maneuver. He's not without political skill. Number three, and I don't want to lose sight of the story because it is and was so important. Hannah Gutierrez Reed, she was the armorer on the set of Rust, where the cinematographer Helena Hutchins was killed accidentally. She was sentenced yesterday to 18 months in prison after being found guilty of involuntary manslaughter. She got the maximum sentence from a New Mexico judge. Alec Baldwin, of course, is the one who pulled the trigger. He is also facing prosecution. He had no way of knowing that this prop gun contained a live round of ammunition. Whose fault was that? Well, I would say the armorer. Not to completely exonerate Baldwin, but he has pleaded not guilty. Prosecutors say that Gutierrez Reed, who was in charge of safety and storage of firearms, was neglectful in her responsibility. Oh, you think? The DA said that she was likely hungover when she handed Baldwin the gun in question. The defense said she was being scapegoated. It's such a tragedy, and somebody's now been held accountable. Story four. I've spent a lot of time reporting on and talking to about the award-winning NPR senior business editor who's taken on his own network and said it's gone from being left-leaning to off the rails in terms of left-wing activism. Well, the new CEO of NPR, Catherine Maher, a lot of her old tweets have been dug up. And here she is defending NPR, ripping Uri Berliner, the whistleblower. And it just seems to me, if you look at what she has done and said in the past. So, for example, she actually criticized Hillary Clinton in 2016 for erasing language for non-binary people by employing the phrase boy and girl. Can you imagine? In another old tweet, she said, as someone with cis white mobility privilege, some idea where she's coming from, she's peeved about getting on airplanes in business class and seeing mostly white men. Then during the 2020 riots after the murder of George Floyd, she said, well, you know, looting is counterproductive, but it's hard to be mad about protests, not prioritizing the private property of a system of oppression founded on treating people's ancestors as private property. I mean, this is pretty left-wing stuff. She goes on to say, no one is condoning looting, but placing the value of property over the value of people's lives is a moral failure. She also applauded the New York Times for firing then editorial page editor James Bennett for running that op-ed, online op-ed by GOP Senator Tom Cotton, calling for the use of military to quell the riots. The piece is full of racist dog whistles. It's also based on a false premise that the country is in a state of disorder. Okay, you're free to disagree, but it shouldn't have been published. And the guy who published it should have been fired. Talk about a lack of tolerance. And then, in November of 2020, Catherine Marr was publicly saying that she was participating in get-out-the-vote efforts for the Biden campaign. And she's pictured wearing a Biden cap. Now, does that sound to you like somebody who's not just very, very, very liberal, but has shown an intolerance for other views, which is the essence of the criticism by NPR's own Uri Berliner? Some other media items. It took 6 months and really bad ratings, but the CNN primetime show King Charles has been dropped. It's not about King Charles. It's Gayle King and Charles Barkley. Now, I think Gayle King is a terrific journalist. She's not just Oprah's friend. And I like Barkley in the context of talking about sports and everything. Two of them put together didn't quite work. And CNN has now ended it. The Daily Beast, where I once worked, when it certainly leaned left, but wasn't the sort of constantly liberal anti-Trump site that it is today. Barry Diller, the owner, the billionaire, was looking to dump it because he's losing money. Diller's a businessman. Well, now he's made a deal with Ben Sherwood, former president of Disney ABC Television Group, as well as former president of ABC News, and Joanna Coles, former chief content officer of Hearst Magazines. They will be granted an equity stake equivalent to 49% of the Daily Beast, leaving Diller in control with 51%. If they can turn the site around and bring it financial success, they can grow its business. They'll be paid salaries. Sherwood will be the CEO. And Diller already tried to sell it to Janice Min, who is with Ankler Media, but former top editor of The Hollywood Reporter. That didn't work out. When Ben and Joanna made this presentation, I'd really gotten to the point where I was kind of skeptical that anything would work out other than selling it, said Diller. But I was so impressed with their concept, their energy, and their interest. So what are they planning to do? Well, they want to have subscriptions, so there'll be a partial paywall. And they want to boost advertising, who doesn't, and hold events like every other website around. And Sherwood made a lot of money when he founded a youth sports company called Mojo and then sold it to Snapchat. So we'll see how it works out. But I would say if they don't succeed in taking it from the red to the black, this will probably be sold to somebody.
Hey, let's pause right there. The buzz meter continues right after this.
And finally, story five, a deep dive by the Wall Street Journal. With the tantalizing lead, the New York Times is investigating itself. For the past several weeks, top Times editor Charlotte Berendt, who is in charge of workplace issues, has summoned close to 20 employees for interviews about whether staffers leaked confidential information related to the Gaza war coverage to another media outlet, which was The Intercept. And you might think this is just inside baseball, but it's the same thing about it as NPR. It's a revolt within a woke newsroom. Reporting about the Gaza war has been a particular flashpoint, especially over an in-depth article that found Hamas weaponized sexual violence in the brutal, barbaric October 7th attacks on Israel. Now, the reason there's an internal investigation is to find out who leaked information for a planned podcast episode. And what I like about this piece is that Joe Kahn, who's the executive editor, probably the lowest key New York Times executive editor of my adult lifetime. I mean, whether you liked the other editors or not, we were talking about people who were giant figures, Abe Rosenthal, Joe Lelyveld, Howell Raines, who lost his job for the Jason Blair fabrication scandal. which I broke and covered extensively, and many others. Dean Baquet, Jill Abramson. But here he comes out and gives an extensive interview. That is very rare for Joe Cotton. The idea that someone dips into that process in the middle and finds something they considered might be interesting or damaging to the story underway and then provides that to people outside, says Cotton, felt to me and my colleagues like a breakdown in the sort of trust and collaboration that's necessary in the editorial process. I haven't seen that happen before. Now, Cotton says that the organization has added a lot of digital savvy workers who were skilled in data analysis, design, product engineering, but weren't trained in independent journalism. He suggested, says the journal, that colleges aren't preparing new hires to be tolerant of dissenting views. Here's more from Kahn. Young adults who are coming up through this education system are less accustomed to this sort of open debate, this sort of robust exchange of views around issues they feel strongly about than may have been in the case in the past. He says he welcomes internal debate, but that this leak is a really serious matter. So, now others have a different view. So, since the woman, Berendt, who's conducting this internal probe, has called in a bunch of people to be interviewed, and at least one session lasted longer than an hour, one staffer complained that the piece, in a letter to the standards department, and Berendt, who got the letter from another source, called in the author for questioning. She asked if anyone else had helped her write the letter. And for her communications with a worker on the Times' own daily podcast, Stacy Cowley, a business reporter and Times union officer who sat in on the interviews, said the Times is targeting employees who've been struggling to get the company to listen to their concerns about war-related coverage. Instead of taking them seriously, the company is turning around and bullying that group into silence, said Stacy Cowley. Unionists filed a grievance that the company was targeting a group of staffers of Arab and Middle Eastern descent. One can understand why they might have a different point of view. Coverage of the Israel-Hamas war has been particularly fraught at the Times, with some reporters saying the Times' work is tilting in favor of Israel up against the Hamas terrorist group, which, of course, launched this war with the aforementioned October 7th attack, And here's Khan again. Just like our readers at the moment, there are really, really strong passions about that issue, and not that much willingness to really explore the perspectives of people who are on the other side of that divide. And he says it's hard to ask workers to put their commitment to journalism ahead of their own personal views. And there are other examples where they've been at odds. And Peter Baker, chief White House correspondent, you often see him on MSNBC, said some internal criticism can be healthy. We should be open to criticism, says Peter. Think about what it means for our coverage without allowing our independence to be compromised. And then, like, way down in the piece, like next to last paragraph, it says, the Times isn't the only news organization where employees have become more vocal in complaints about coverage and workplace practices. War coverage has also fueled tensions at the Wall Street Journal, with some reporters in meetings and internal chat groups complaining that coverage is skewed, either favoring Israel or Palestinians. So that's the insulation paragraph, knowing that somebody can come back and say, wait, you got a problem with this at the Wall Street Journal too. But it's good, solid reporting by the Wall Street Journal about the New York Times, and the leaks are concerning. But that seems to be the main focus. But here you have Joe Kahn saying, look, a lot of people, they only care about their personal views. They're not tolerant. They come out of the education system and they're not tolerant of anybody else's views. And we need to change that. This is a problem at many news organizations. Well, thanks so much for listening, particularly to this deep dive. We'll see you all tomorrow with more BuzzMeter.
Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts and via Apple Podcasts, and Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on Amazon Music.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. In these ever-changing times, you can rely on Fox News for hourly updates for the very latest news and information on your time. Listen and download now at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.